From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Holly Mullen of the Rape Recovery Center says it's a centuries-old trope. Women are the keeper of their chastity and safety. So throughout history, when a woman gets raped, she also often gets blamed for what she was wearing or where she had been or what she had been drinking. For Mullen, when you're discussing the epidemic of sexual assault on college campuses and you bring up the fact that alcohol or binge drinking may have played a role, then, well, you're right back there blaming the victim. But alcohol is playing a role in these assaults, so how do you talk about it? How do you create prevention programs that include alcohol in the mix? That's what we're talking about today, though, as you'll see, the issue is a bit of a taboo, and it's understandably making a lot of people uneasy. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing a series of conversations on sexual assault on college campuses throughout the country. A few weeks ago, we discussed the structural problems of college culture that puts students at risk. Today, we're going to shift to prevention, that is how you prevent sexual assault. But we're going to focus on what some think is at the center of this problem, and that's the abuse of alcohol, binge drinking. Universities and assault prevention groups, though, are uneasy about discussing the role of alcohol. They say it leads to blaming the victim. So today, we'll try and put this story in context and ask, how do you talk about this issue? How do you address this issue? How do you craft prevention programs with or without the element of alcohol? I should mention that earlier this month, Westminster College hosted a statewide symposium to address the issues of sexual assault on campus, and we invited Westminster to join us. They declined because of our focus being on alcohol today, saying that it was just too narrow in its scope. That will have a representative from the school with us later in the series when we talk about other issues and legal issues. We invite you to join this conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. We're going to begin with Robin Wilson today, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's written a series of articles about sexual assault and alcohol on college campuses. She's joining us today from her office. And Robin Wilson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
I want to begin. Let's just jump in here so we can get our bearings a bit. Where does alcohol fit in the story of sexual assault on campuses? It's not the only factor here, but it's very much a common element. It's fair to say that?
It's fair to say that. Research into common elements in sex assault, you know, it's found that between 50 and 80% of both the victims and people who they accuse of sex assault have been drinking. Not clear to what extent, whether they're all intoxicated, whether they're incapacitated. But alcohol is involved in, you know, up to 80% of sex assaults. So it's I think, fair to say that it's possibly the most common element in sex assault.
You point out, you've written an article on this, a number of articles about this, and you've pointed out that while preventing sexual assault is, the top of the agenda on a lot of campuses now, people in charge feel that they can't really talk about it. And I wanted to explore why that is. In one of your articles that you wrote, you quote a social science researcher who called the discussion of alcohol and rape and sexual violence the third rail of discourse. I mean, this is something that no one really wants to go near. Now, why is that?
You know, the thing is that even though between 50 and 80% of the cases there's alcohol involved, research also shows, and campus administrators feel that if they talk to students about their own alcohol use and the message gets out to potential victims that they should not drink, that they'll then, if they do drink and drink to excess, and are assaulted, that they'll blame themselves. That instead of reporting the incident as something where someone has assaulted them, they'll think of it as their fault,
right,
because of their own behavior. And that's something that colleges want to avoid. And so that's the main reason that campuses, when talking about prevention methods in terms of sex assault, don't go there.
Now, it's interesting, one of the things you point out, there were a couple of interesting stories and I wanted to ask you about. The first one is, it wasn't so long ago that the president emeritus of George Washington University mentioned in an NPR interview that college women could protect themselves if they just drank less. But it caused a real uproar. And he was kind of taken aback by that. He was shocked at how incredibly controversial it was. Tell that story.
Yeah, so I think he was, and I think a lot of people are, because it's the kind of thing, as he told me later, that you naturally even say to your children, or in his case, grandchildren, mm-hmm. whether they're girls or boys, you say, watch what you drink to protect yourself. And yet when he did that, on an NPR show, and he also, by the way, said that women, if they didn't drink, could pop the guy in the nose. Wow. To protect themselves against sex assault. I mean, that again is something else that people thought was out of touch. But in terms of, you know, in terms of what he said about alcohol, victims' rights organizations who quickly took him to task and wrote letters to him, even students on his own campus, said, look, this isn't about what women are drinking. This isn't about women keeping themselves safe. This is about the men who are responsible for assaulting them. Please direct your messages to them. Don't tell us all the ways in which we can alter our own behavior as women. And so that's where a lot of the backlash comes from.
One of the things you also wrote about was that grant programs won't fund programs on college campuses that emphasize the idea of changing a victim's behavior. You can't even get money to fund these programs.
So the longest running program out of the Department of Justice, the longest running grant program for 15 years now, to help colleges set up programs to teach students how to prevent sex assault, tells them that the primary focus of those programs cannot be victim behavior change or directed at alcohol and substance use. And so as a result, you know, colleges have listened and they've followed those rules in, and they want to get that grant money. They know that their programs on sex assault prevention cannot focus on alcohol. And so many of them do focus on alcohol. So don't mistake the fact that even though they don't talk about alcohol in sex assault prevention programs to the extent some people think they should, they certainly are talking about alcohol, but they separate it, you know. So when one college told me, yeah, you know, we have our wellness director who talks to students about alcohol use all the time. And for a long time, colleges have been doing that, but they don't necessarily talk about it when it comes to sex assault prevention. And so that's led some researchers, even those who are victim advocates, to say, look, you know, it's information that you need to be telling students in general in terms of how to protect themselves. That doesn't mean you should blame them if they've been drinking and they're assaulted. And so researchers who study the issue will point that out. But even they urge campuses to talk more about the use of alcohol and the influence that it has in sex assault.
So if you're uneasy about making a link between alcohol and sexual assault, you know, on a college campus, if you can't get any grant money to fund programs that do make that link or do talk about that connection, what do you do instead? What are some of the programs that some of these colleges, these universities are focusing on instead? And this is a very important part of this question. Do they work? Are they as effective as the others might be?
So what they're doing now, and the sort of most popular program, it seems to me, is something called bystander intervention. So you can talk about alcohol as long as you don't tell individual students how much they should drink or not drink or alter their own behavior. What you do instead is you say to students, look, you can keep your friends safe by watching over them. So you can watch if one of your friends appears to be have drank too much at a party, and you see him or her look like they're going to maybe leave the party with someone they don't know that well, you might want to intervene. You're the bystander here. You're the friend. You might want to intervene and say to them, look, maybe you should wait till tomorrow. Maybe you should get the person's phone number and text them instead of leave right now. Or maybe you are a fraternity brother who sees a friend of his who's you can see you drank too much, and is, you know, saying and doing things that you think probably might get him into trouble with other people. Right. You want to go up to that fraternity brother and say, hey, let's walk over here. Let's go outside for a while. And so campuses tell students that by keeping their friends safe, they can keep their whole community safe. And their friends will then keep them safe. And so it's a less direct message, and they can talk about alcohol in that way without telling individual students to alter their behavior. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so that's what they're doing most.
That's what they're doing most. The question is, do they have to walk such a fine line that they're not as effective as they could be? I mean, if you have to leave the sort of alcohol question out of it, at least be direct about it, can you really address the actual issue? And is it making these programs less effective?
You know, I think what the campus administrators who direct these programs would say is that if you tell individual students that preach at them like their parents may have, you're not very effective either. That statistics probably show that all the talk that parents have done to their own kids about what to drink and what not to drink and how much to drink and alcohol and drugs may not have had the effect that the parents wanted either. So it's not clear to administrators that if they directly address the issue with students, that really would have been that much more effective. I'm not sure that they actually have statistics yet. I don't think they do on whether bystander intervention works. I've heard individual stories when I've gone to campuses about it working. I went to Dartmouth, and I heard the very story I told you of a young woman who her friend had been drinking a lot at a party, and a young man had been talking to the young woman. And the man said to the person I talked to, hey, I'd like to go someplace else with your friend, but you tell me, is she too drunk to make that kind of decision? And the woman I talked to said, yeah, I think she is.
Yeah.
And he listened, and he got her phone number, and he contacted her later. And so that's exactly the kind of thing that campuses want to happen in this case.
I wonder, Robin Wilson, if you think that, is it the college's job, because you address this matter in one of your articles, is it the college's or the university's job to shape a student's social behavior? Because you point out most undergraduates already have absorbed messages about alcohol and sex from all these other kinds of sources, parents and friends and the media. Is it the university's job to really deal with that part, their social behavior?
I think campuses most definitely think it's their job, and they have for a long time. And they've had hearing boards and disciplinary processes that have looked at all sorts of student behavior and punished students or dealt with student misbehavior for a long time. And they now see sex assault as just one more of those things. But I think campuses, depending on what kind you're talking about, you know, to varying degrees, whether you're talking about a very small liberal arts college up to a very large research university, I think they probably have differing ideas about how effective they can be in shaping students' behavior.
Right.
But I do think that they believe that while students may have been drinking during high school, that in fact, when they come to college, they're on their own for the first time without parents, and that they're exploring, and that they're deciding who they are, and that they're socializing in a way, which they're less accountable. They don't have to go home, you know, to mom and dad every night. And so that their behavior is different. And so colleges see it actually, I think, as a prime time to try to influence young adults and their behavior, especially because I think research shows that so much binge drinking goes on campuses. And so colleges think it's their job and they're doing it.
Do you think, after doing all this coverage on the issue, does it have to be that when you talk about the problem of alcohol, that it just naturally has to take on the question of blame? I mean, is there a way to have it both ways, I guess, is what I'm asking. Discuss openly the fact that alcohol is a common element, but also create initiatives that address that and make it a provision that stops short of blaming a woman if it does happen. I mean, can you have it both ways? And are there college presidents and administrators in the country who are finding a way to strike that balance, do you think?
I haven't found them yet.
Really?
I think that because it's the third rail, I think people are reluctant to go there. I think that, you know, you can talk to students about alcohol, and they do get the message. Students know what campuses and their parents and everybody think about what they should do and how much they should drink. But I did talk to young women for my story on why colleges don't talk about alcohol that much when they talk about sex assault prevention. And there's a very strong feeling that they personally know what the message is. They've heard it from their parents. They may have heard it separately from administrators. But they very much resent the fact that they're being told that their own behavior should have anything to do with whether somebody forces them to have sex with them or not. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to, as one woman I spoke to said, you know, walk around worrying about putting her hair in a ponytail when she's off campus. You know, she goes to college in New York City for fear that somebody's going to pull it and use it. And that's not about her and her wearing her hair in a ponytail. It's about the person who's pulling her hair. And that's the behavior that we need to change, is what she would say. So there's a very strong feeling on the part of students that, mostly female students, that it's not about them. So I think there's a pushback. And you saw what happened when, like you said, the former president of George Washington University said we should talk to students about alcohol. There was an immediate pushback, and the same thing has happened with other articles written about alcohol and sex assault.
It seems like in some ways for you to really address the issue of alcohol and sexual assault, you're going to have to get through a lot of the gender questions that are still at issue, the sort of power issues, the gender inequality, those kinds of things. It seems like you may have to move through some of that before you're even willing to deal with that direct linkage between alcohol and sexual assault.
And I don't know if that'll happen. I do know that when I talk about sex assault, when I'm interviewing people, they remind me that I shouldn't call victims female all the time, or perpetrators male. So although we often think in terms of heterosexual gender norms, that's not the only case. But I think that on college campuses, people get the message when they look at what's happening, though, and when they see that young men are being punished for sex assault and women are bringing reports as victims, they see what's happening. And you know, I wrote a story about men who feel that campuses have now tipped the scales in the other direction and are looking to protect victims to the point at which they're not offering due process to men accused of sex assault and kicking them off campus. Now, there's a lot of controversy over that. Yeah. Some victims believe that it's only just started to happen, that campuses are listening to women who have said they've been assaulted, that for years campuses ignored that. But this is a really gendered issue. So I'm not sure if moving beyond it's possible.
That's Robin Wilson, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, spoke to us today from her office. Robin Wilson, thank you very much for spending the time.
Thank you.
We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing a series of conversations about sexual assault on the country's college campuses. We've talked about the context for this issue. Today, we're moving on to prevention, that is, what schools can do to keep it from happening in the first place. But at the center of all of this is the matter of alcohol and binge drinking. But for all kinds of different reasons, schools, even advocacy groups, are uneasy discussing alcohol alongside rape. And we're talking about why and how you do talk about that, if you do. Joining us now on the program is Kathleen Bogle, who is an associate professor of sociology and criminology at LaSalle University, author of the book Hooking Up, Sex, Dating, and Relationships on Campus. She's joining us from a studio on LaSalle's campus in Philadelphia. And Kathleen Bogle, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to begin with a story that Robin Wilson, whom we were just speaking with earlier, tells in an article of a talk that you were going to give. I'm not sure how long ago this was. You were asked by federal officials to give this talk, and they wanted you to take the word alcohol from it. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that in terms of the taboo, really, the difficulty in talking about this issue.
Yeah, 2008, the year my book came out, I got invited to give this talk, the keynote address, at this event that was organized by the Department of Justice. And, you know, they were going to fly me out to California and all of that kind of stuff. And they had read my op-ed in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which talked about the links between hooking up, alcohol, and sexual assault. And even though they invited me after reading that op-ed, when I actually sent them my title, which included the word alcohol, they asked me to remove that from the title. And they said, well, I can mention, you know, incapacitation with regard to sexual assault, but they don't want that as the focus, or they don't want that in the title. So, you know, I kind of learned a long time ago how there's these different camps when it comes to the sexual assault issue, and often a tug of war over how we should focus on it, this whole issue of victim blaming that you were talking about in your first segment. So there's a lot of people out there that have their hooks into this issue and a tug of war going on about how we teach about it, how we publicly present it.
Is that tug of war making it worse? Is it helping?
No, I think it's making it worse because I think that students are the ones that lose out while we're giving them mixed messages about what's happening. You know, when you raise the question of can we talk about alcohol without victim blaming, imagine if we told people don't lock your homes, don't lock your cars, because people shouldn't be burglarizing, people shouldn't be stealing cars. Well, of course, rapists should not be raping, but we still tell people to lock their homes, we still tell people to lock their cars, we still tell people to use security systems and keep themselves safe. So when you're talking about such a serious crime, you know, the idea that we're going to not tell people things that put them at risk. Now, I agree 100%. We can't focus on that exclusively as if that's how we reduce the problem. We just have women, you know, add something to the list of behaviors they need to change. I agree 100%. We don't want to do that. But we do have to talk about the alcohol issue. And one thing I think you missed maybe in your first segment is it's not just that alcohol's involved in the sexual assault, that according to the Harvard School of Public Health, 72% of the cases, the victim is too drunk to give consent.
Right.
And that means that there isn't force used, there isn't threats used to bring about the sexual assault. They're so drunk they can't resist. And so we need to look at that issue, and not only because we want to tell women, watch your drinking, not at all. We also want to talk to perpetrators about this is what consent means, and a certain level of intoxication means you can no longer give consent.
Well, I did want to actually get to that issue of consent because it's something that you've written about. You did an op-ed piece for Slate that I wanted to ask you about. And you write about how that college campuses need to develop these guidelines about when it's a crime to have sex with a person who's drunk. And you talk about how the rules need to be clear to students, they need to be clear to police, they need to be clear to administrators who are investigating all of these things. So what is the legal framework? How does that play out?
The legal framework is that there is a protection, you know, with most states saying that if the victim is too drunk to give consent, that it would be considered a sexual assault, even if she does not physically fight off the attacker, or even if she doesn't say no. Perhaps she's passed out, she's in and out of passing out, and of course it can be a male victim in some cases, but it's more likely to be a woman. But how they actually say, well, how could we ever prosecute such a case, because you obviously don't make a very good witness if you're saying, I'm so drunk I barely remember what happened, or I'm so drunk I blacked out. So the idea is, you know, do we have other people, which there often are at college parties, that saw that someone was falling down drunk, someone could barely walk, someone was trying to light a cigarette and was lighting the wrong end of it because they were so drunk and out of it. So if you have witnesses that can say someone was that intoxicated, then they can become the witnesses that say the person obviously couldn't give consent. A reasonable person, which is the standard used in law, a reasonable person would not have thought that that person was coherent enough to give consent. But colleges don't want to do that. So not only do some colleges not want to bring up the alcohol issue, or they try to keep it separate, they have a separate program on it, when they do bring up the alcohol issue, they issue this blanket statement of, well, when you're drinking, you can't give consent. Or don't mix drinking and hooking up, don't mix drinking and sex ever, it's a dangerous combination. Well, we're talking about campuses nationwide where hookup culture is often normative, and hookup culture, you know, almost always involves drinking. So my argument is you can't just issue these blanket statements and say, never mix the two, because then students just roll their eyes and laugh off what we're trying to teach them. Mm-hmm. You have to actually teach them the law that says you're not protected in most cases when you're drinking, and young women need to know that, only in cases of extreme intoxication, and there are visible signs of that. And when those visible signs are there, then we can bring forward a campus complaint. Then we can bring forward a criminal complaint.
The programs, I wonder if you see an element of, it seems like some of these programs, your perspective might be that they're a little patronizing. Because you've said, look, it doesn't empower women to not tell them the truth. Are you saying that they need to develop programs that don't censor any of this issue, that women, men too, frankly, can handle the reality of this connection?
I think they need to handle the reality of it, and I think, frankly, some of the cases are very, very ugly, and I think you need to show people that. You know, it's not just rapes, there's sometimes gang rapes on college campuses where the victim is extremely intoxicated, can barely walk, doesn't know what's going on. You know, and we've seen this not only happen at the college level, we've seen at the high school level with the famous Steubenville, Ohio case, et cetera. So we see these cases where the person is extremely intoxicated. There's been cases where things have been videotaped and passed around. There's really ugly behaviors that have gone on in conjunction with this. And I think we need to very honestly talk to college students about, look, you know, we know there's a lot of drinking that goes on college campuses, but there's still rules. Even if you're violating the law by drinking, there's still rules for how you behave while drinking. And, you know, these are the kind of cases where we can bring something forward, and these are the kind of cases where we can bring a criminal complaint. But people tend to interpret it as, oh, they're saying, you know, any drinking and it's a sexual assault. That isn't the case. It's only in those extreme cases.
Here's a question from Mike, who's writing from Park City. He says, why is there no discussion about liability of schools or frats or other places where these sexual assaults are happening? He says these perps and victims are underage and drinking to begin with. Why don't the schools say that if you get caught drunk on campus, you'll face the consequences? And then let me just sort of broaden that as a question, Kathleen Bogle. What about this whole liability issue for universities and things like that? Is that an element here that we need to be talking about?
Well, that's how it's kind of gotten so much attention over the past year, is because someone came up with the idea of filing a Title IX complaint because right. Universities weren't taking it seriously. But here's what's interesting to me. To me, when universities do address alcohol, they tend to give, like I'm saying, this kind of blanket statement that, you know, you never mix the two, or anything where you mix the two is a sexual assault, which is kind of preposterous. Obviously, it's normative nationwide that lots of people have a drink and meet people at bars and meet people at parties, and in some cases something sexual happens. So we can't issue these blanket statements. But schools don't want to get into, well, this is, you know, when the person's this drunk, then you really can't do it or whatever, because I think they don't want to be seen as endorsing the drinking culture, which is one of the things they're trying to stop. And think about all the religious-affiliated schools. They don't, you know, endorse students being sexually active. So the idea of saying, well, this is how drunk you can be for sex and this is how drunk is against the law, is not a message that they want to embrace, but they really have to.
Give us a sense of the campaign that you have in mind. I mean, if you could craft one of these campaigns on a college campus, you've mentioned MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They've convinced the public that it's not okay to get drunk and drive. It seems like you're thinking of something like that.
I am thinking of something like that. I mean, when you think about it, if we go back a few decades before Mothers Against Drunk Driving convinced us that drinking and driving wasn't okay, it was very common for people to drink and drive. It was kind of like, well, who's in the best shape? That'll be the person that drives home. Just drive slowly. And then Mothers Against Drunk Driving, through public service announcement, through commercials, through lobbying, the criminal justice system, said, no, this isn't okay. Look at these tragedies that happen. Look at these horrible cases. Look at these children that have been killed by drunk drivers. And they said, it's not okay anymore. And they had a message that, friends aren't going to let friends do this. Friends aren't going to let friends drink and drive. And to me, we need to do that with regard to sexual assault, where we've got to sell the general public and the student body on the idea that when you reach a certain level of intoxication, you can no longer give consent. And we're not saying it's after two or three drinks. We're talking about at a higher level of drinking. But a higher level of drinking is unfortunately very common on college campuses where drinking can get out of hand. And if we had that, then we would be able to bring successful cases at the college level, but also successful criminal cases, which is what we rarely see. The Steubenville, Ohio case, even though it was a high school case, was one of the first cases we could point to where people were actually held accountable for their actions. And honestly, I think that was only because they had, caught them with Twitter and various things with commenting on what they did. So they knew that the people were very aware of how drunk the girl was and went forward anyway. But if we can make that normative, that it's not okay when someone is that drunk, we could dramatically reduce sexual assault on campus.
You feel optimistic about the or do you feel like we need to really get through some major obstacles before we can really sort of frontally deal with this?
I think it's major obstacles because, like I said, there's a lot of different interest groups that have their hooks in this issue. So feminists, and I get where they're coming from, that they're tired of this laundry list of things that women need to do. Don't walk alone at night. Safety in numbers. Watch your drink. Don't have too much to drink. I see why they're bothered by that continual list. But when Harvard School of Public Health, which is a pretty prestigious place to gather data, says that 72% of the cases the victim is too drunk to give consent, it's pretty hard to ignore that number. But we have feminists with their interest in the case. We have public health people who don't necessarily want to address sexual assault directly as much as they want to do things to reduce alcohol problems and then say, well, as a byproduct, the sexual assault issue will go down. And then you have students that have become advocates around this issue, et cetera. So you have all these different places on the left and right that are, like I said at the beginning of the program, having a tug of war while meanwhile rapes continue to happen.
It's Kathleen Bogle, an associate professor of sociology and criminology at LaSalle University, who joined us from the campus there. Kathleen Bogle, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. I think we can take your calls at this point in the program. I'm sorry about that. We're having some technical issues. 801-585-WEST again, or just an email, radiowest@kuer.org is the address. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue a series of conversations about sexual assault on the country's college campuses. We've been talking about prevention. In particular, what is the link between alcohol and sexual assault on campus? And how do you talk about it? Is it when you do you end up blaming the victim? 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Holly Mullen is with us now. She's the executive director of the Rape Recovery Center here in Salt Lake City. And Holly, I guess you've been thinking a lot about this issue over the past little while.
All the time. Thank you.
Let's start. And let me have you just sort of give us a sense of what you're hearing so far. So what you're hearing so far is that, in essence, people are being censored from dealing with this. They can't, you know, you can't get grant money. Universities are uneasy about talking. I mean, we already encountered this. I have to say, there have been a number of college presidents in universities themselves that we've contacted. And when we use the word alcohol, they don't even want to talk about it, or they want us to somehow not deal with it. What do you make of that? Before we get to the question of whether or not it, in fact, does end up blaming mm-hmm. victims, which we'll deal with, but what do you make of the general idea that people are just uneasy talking about it because it's such a taboo?
Well, I think it's that they're more uneasy with talking about sexual assault and rape culture and a bigger, broader, very intensive, very deep conversation about why it is that, and because most of this entails male on female sexual assault, I'm going to use that as my backdrop, why it is that males grow up in a culture and continue to feel it's okay to act out aggressively against women, whether drunk or sober. That's the topic. That's the tough one. That one takes a long time.
We don't like talking about that.
We don't like to talk about sex in any way
right.
in our
Even though
society.
We're a sexualized sort of popular
culture. Oh, we love
culture.
To do it. And then when you add what we call bro culture on top of it, which is what you're seeing in the NFL and all the talk that we're hearing right now, when you add all that together, it's a huge talk and we never quite get to it, ever.
Begita sent this. I think the show hits on a fundamental issue in pointing out how young men need to be educated on women's rights and self-sovereignty. It is the lack of respect for a woman's self-ownership that fuels this rampant problem on college campuses. Women should feel safe around any man that is not a previous sexual felon or psychopath. Men have to cease being a potential threat just by their mere presence. What do you make of that? This idea that this is what this question is about. Young men need to be educated on that.
Exactly. I agree with her. And let me add that 8 out of 10 men do not rape, do not batter, do not violate women's autonomy. But the 2 out of 10 who do, we need to watch out for. I needed to take issue, for instance, with Professor Bogle's book title, which I get that you need to have a really catchy title to sell books. But hooking up is not rape. Hooking up, to me, has a connotation of two people meeting together, consenting to have sex or to have a dating relationship. Rape is the absolute violent taking of someone else's power. And there's a difference. So that's just, you know, maybe I'm picking fly specks out of the pepper there. But that's one of the issues I have.
But it is about semantics, isn't it? I mean, when you're talking, this does seem like a language issue, what you can and cannot say. And at what point in a conversation when you're talking about binge drinking, mm-hmm. does it become blaming the victim? You do worry about this. I mean, language does matter, I guess, in all of this.
It does matter. And I do have to go back. I don't think I am willing, Doug, to concede that women need to be more involved and more told more about protection and safety. I can speak about this because I am a woman, and women come out of the womb and grow up with a backdrop of living in fear. There's a really great exercise that's been done several times where I've been involved with someone stands in the front of a room of a group of male and females and says, "Okay, women in the room, share with us what you did today to protect yourself from sexual assault." And the hands just go everywhere. "I lock my car doors. I never run alone. I never go out at night. I never leave my drink alone in a bar." And then they ask the same question to men in the room, and there's a big dead pause. Because men might be afraid of getting mugged on a dark street at night, but it very rarely goes to their sexuality and their power and their sense of self-worth and control the way it does for women. So by the time a woman gets to be a freshman in college, she has had these lectures. She has had this fear from the time she was able to walk. It's not that she doesn't need to be reminded to be sensible, but we've got to start holding male perpetrators accountable. And can I just quickly add, rape is not. The public tends to believe that rape is a random act. That's kind of an impulse control issue. Kids get carried away, and then the next thing you know, someone's crying rape. Rapists are purposeful, predatory people who prey on vulnerable victims. And there will be a rapist. I hate to sound like I'm insane here. I worry about this sometimes. There's going to be a rapist in a big room of people at a party, at least one on campus, and is going to be driven to that antisocial behavior no matter what. And it isn't just because the girl across the room drank too much. It's because he wants to hurt someone and take her power away. And he will do it if he can get away with it and not be held accountable.
What did you make of the reference earlier of Kathleen Bogle mentioned it from Harvard that said 72% of women in those sexual assault situations were too drunk to give consent?
It's probably true. I mean, I'm sure it's true. I'm sure it's true. And legally, I believe in every state, it's true. A person cannot give a consent to sex if they are drunk. And it's deeply unfortunate. It truly is. But I think we would have even less problem drinking and sexual issues around problem drinking if perpetrators were held more accountable. And in fact, perpetrators often get a pass on campuses because they were drunk, because they couldn't be responsible for their actions, because they drank too much. And if they're not being punished, kicked off campus, put on probation, whatever it is, it will continue, just as it does in society when they're not held accountable.
Let me get to a few responses from listeners. Pablo phoned in earlier, and we were able to sort of get his comment. He said he thinks it's absolutely okay to talk about alcohol and how women need to behave. I think it's necessary because it will take a long time to change men's behavior. I have two young daughters. I think it would be great to change the behavior of men, but in the meantime, I have to protect my daughters. So I want them to be thinking about how to protect themselves, not how to change the world. They need to know that if they drink too much, they can become a victim. They need to be able to protect themselves even physically if they need to. What do you think about that?
I'm glad. I think he should have that talk with his daughters as many times and as often as he wants to. But I also think he should hopefully want daughters that want to change the world, because the world is still too far based on the fact that males are programmed to be aggressive, and if they want sex, they can have it without asking or without getting clear, enthusiastic consent from another person. And that's just wrong.
It's interesting, in Robin Wilson's article, she quotes a graduate from Duke who actually writes about sexual assault now for the American Enterprise Institute. Caroline Kitchens is her name. And Kitchens wrote this. She said, in a perfect world, women would be able to do whatever they want, but the world isn't perfect. There are always evil people out there. If they exist, we have to practice some common sense risk reduction, which means talking about alcohol, she's saying. That's her point, though.
It does. It does. And I need to just kind of jump in. I'm very familiar with the activity, for instance, that's going on at the U of U campus around this topic. And I think perhaps it's unfair. Maybe we're talking about other campuses. I'm aware that there is a lot going on, and there are discussions of alcohol use and overuse and sexual assault.
Right. I've been. So you're saying
I've been there. I've been to several discussions on campus as well as more off. The fraternity and sorority community is really active in this right now, particularly the Beta Theta Pi House, which I work with directly, with a mentorship program, with bystander intervention, which, by the way, I think that's kind of getting a bad rap on the program with some of the guests. It's very effective and it's been well-researched. It's an effective program, and it should be practiced.
Yeah, they, I don't think they like it. I think they think it's just
namby-pamby.
Yeah, mamby-pamby. Women know this stuff. It's patronizing. It doesn't have a real, actual
But men need to be encouraged to stand against bystanders, or excuse me, against sexual assault. Men need to pull a guy away and say, stop. What you're doing is beyond the pale. Stop. You know, just be really that direct about it. And that is what the U of U Center for Student Wellness has done and is doing. And it's a really effective group of people over there.
So let's set aside the alcohol question then for a moment and talk about programs like that one. So you are seeing programs that that you think are working?
I do. I'm really impressed with the Beta Theta Pi model. Very quickly, they were kicked off campus a few years ago. They were bad boys. They were Animal House, basically. They've since recolonized. They have a very strict risk management program in effect. They now have a dry house. We can't be responsible for what they do if they go away off campus somewhere. But for instance, if a member of the Beta House is caught drinking on the grounds or in the house, they have to pay $250 to the chapter. They have regular monthly meetings in which mentors like myself are present to discuss risk management and bystander intervention and the link between over drinking and sexual assault. And I can't say that may be true of all the fraternities, but there were at least 20 fraternity and sorority members present at the Westminster event last weekend to talk about assault on campus.
Brian from Provo writes in, why don't we just get rid of frats and this ultra-masculinity culture? A lot of the problems, he said, I saw regarding sex and partying when going to college in the South, those problems were intensified and centered around frats. And clearly you've asked yourself that question, too.
Is it time
to just ditch the whole damn Greek system? Because people are asking that question.
No, you know, I mean, I wasn't involved in that path when I went to school here at the university many moons ago. But I think it's a very important path for people to have a sense of belonging and friendship at a huge university campus. I think the answer is to do, again, what is happening at the Beta House by none other than, I mean, a person that you can really give credit for is Spence Eccles, who is leading the charge. He's an alum, a very powerful alum, calling the men, really, truly having a slogan, men of integrity. They're back trying to be service. They're back trying to do good things for the community and to treat women with respect in the process.
And to sort of strip out the partying culture part
of
it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they still go to parties.
Sure.
They still have formals and whatnot, weekends away. But we're taking the emphasis on that and trying to get back to respect and boundaries.
Cardi writes from Salt Lake City, I think a conversation we need to have is about the conversations we have with our children about how they behave, whether they're inebriated or not. Parents, Cardi writes, need to be open with their children at an early age and teach them how unacceptable sexual assault is. We need to be open and honest with kids about sexuality to avoid the future problems.
Agreed. I think that's perfect. I wanted to also add, when Professor Bogle mentioned a few moments ago about the MAD model, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Yeah, what did you think?
Well, it has worked because of effective public relations and PSAs, but they're also the driving force in most states. I know they are in Utah, about beefing up punishment for drunk drivers. You can't even get caught once with a DUI now without a hefty jail time or fine or both. And I would say that would work great, but let's also, when we do that with rape, let's hold people accountable. Let's test the rape kits. Let's prosecute. Let's throw the book at whomever we can. In this case, hold people accountable. We'll have fewer sexual assaults in society.
There's an article written by Antonia Abbey. Robin Wilson referred to it. She's a professor of social psychology at Wayne State University. She studies violence against women. And she wrote this in the article. She said, the fact that women's alcohol consumption may increase their likelihood of experiencing sexual assault does not make them responsible for the man's behavior. She wrote, being intoxicated allows women to let down their guard, focus on their desire to have fun and be liked rather than on their personal safety. And such information may empower women when used in prevention programs. So what she's saying is you can talk about those issues. If you do it right.
I agree.
And what you're saying is, in some ways, a lot of the time the language we're using in relationship with alcohol and sexual assault, we haven't gotten it right yet.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
I agree. We have not gotten it right, and it's tough. It takes work, and I think more colleges are getting it. President Obama's campaign this year to address this directly as an epidemic is helping. It's really calling people to arms to, you know, I hate to use war metaphors when we talk about rape, but bringing people together to really address this seriously. And that was very helpful, obviously, to this cause.
How are you feeling these days about it all? I mean, I don't want to just sort of simply say, are you pessimistic? Are you optimistic? But I mean, what you're saying, obviously we're talking about it.
Oh, it's
gotta be a good thing.
Fantastic.
Right?
I mean, yep. That is fantastic. And this is, I kind of try to be humorous sometimes in the sense that I say, you know, rape has always been with us. It probably always will be. And all we can do is talk about it and try to change culture, turn it around. And I will continue to try to reframe this argument, not that women shouldn't be aware and safe and take care of themselves as much as possible, but that they are never responsible for a rape and that men need to be responsible for not raping women.
I'll sort of come back around to where I did with Robin Wilson at the end, which was, it seems like before we can really have an honest conversation about this, we've got to get past some stereotypes, mm-hmm. Because this is something you said, it's, you know, centuries old question, holding women, that they're the keepers of their sexual virtue. They're the keepers of their safety. They're the keepers of their
chastity.
Mm-hmm. And we've got to get past that before we have any of those other conversations, it seems. Is that right?
Oh, I totally agree, Doug. And I mean, we see that in spades here in Utah, in our culture. And there have been any number of recent events of, you know, we call it modesty shaming for shorthand, but this sense that you can't even really expose a shoulder without, you know, driving a man crazy. And that kind of thing just builds and builds in a woman's psyche. And that's just not right. That's just not right. We're all sexual creatures. We're all sexual beings. It just needs to be channeled correctly and used appropriately with appropriate boundaries and consent.
Holly Mullen, Executive Director of the Rape Recovery Center in Salt Lake City. Holly, thank you.
Thank you.
We invite you to continue the conversation. You can go to our website, radiowest@kuer.org, and continue the conversation. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.